Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Now, what are you doing on Saturday night? I don't know if you're free. Boris Johnson might invite you to dinner. He's organising a dinner at Chequers to mark 100 years of it being the official country retreat of prime ministers. But quite a lot of people aren't going. Tony Blair's not going. Gordon Brown's not going. John Major's not going. David Cameron's not going. In fact, it may well just be Boris Johnson and Theresa May. And as we know, they get on like a house on fire. But despite all of that, we are using the opportunity to do the history of Chequers. Everything you needed to know about the Prime Minister's retreat, how it ended up being their grace and favour home, what it's like to stay there, what it's like to see a ghost there, and we speak to the DJ who got David Cameron raving when he organised a rave for Sam Camden. That's all that's coming up in our big thing in just a moment. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel, and it's Tuesday, so it must be Finkelwich.
Meet the Cerberus of columnists, the Janus of journalism, and the ultimate political portmanteau of opinion.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Finkelwich, with Daniel Finkelstein and David Aronovich on Times Radio.
Never gets old, that. And, excitingly, Danny Finkelstein is in the studio.
Hello, Matt.
How are you?
I am. I'm fine, thank you very
much. And then beaming in from his Cayman Islands retreat, David Aronovich.
Hi there. It's certainly exciting for Danny's family, I think, because he's out of their hair for once.
That's very unkind on that. No, I think... Oh, there he is. Look, we can see David's there. Is that a new rug or sofa in the background?
No, that's just the shirt I'm wearing.
It's a bright red of hair. Anyway, let's focus on what we're here to talk about. Get in touch as we go along, 8722 site message with the word times. Let's start, first of all, with... government handling of the pandemic, Danny, and later on we're going to get the details of the winter plan, and we do seem to be slightly back into the sort of government wobbles. We were going to have a vaccine passport, then we were following the science, then it was un-British. Is there a slight sense of them not being completely consistent?
Yeah, there's certainly a sense that we don't know exactly what the next step is, but that's been the case all the way through, and I've always argued, you know, right the way through, that is understandable. It's an understandable reaction, and we always try to anticipate what's going to happen. Then we ask loads of questions, which is what, you know, we're all paid to do. The government tries to answer them, which they try, but they don't yet know what the final answer is. So then we end up getting confusion. Personally, I prefer the government to follow the scientific advice. I don't like it when it decides it's going to add in a lot of its own opinions, because I think that the scientific advice is solid. But it has to be said that at the beginning of the pandemic, they did follow the scientific advice, and I think mature reflection suggests that may not have been correct. And the government was then criticised for not having queried the scientific advice and added in what they want. We can't have it both ways. My own view was I was comfortable with that error when they made it at the beginning, because I thought it was made with the best scientific evidence, and sometimes those things, because they're probabilistic, go wrong. I'd prefer it if they stuck with that approach, but you can't criticise them both for following the scientific advice and for not following it.
David, it struck me, and it struck me in the past couple of weeks, even on the radio, when we speak to scientists, every scientist who comes on has a slightly different idea about what we should and shouldn't be doing, which is it's a good reminder that's basically what the Prime Minister and the government has had to face for the last 18 months.
I think this one was a bit different, and it's a bit different because of the way in which Sajid Javid termed his and the government's now opposition to the thing that they had been in favour of a couple of days earlier. He didn't say, actually, or his main argument didn't seem to be that vaccine passports were no longer regarded as being necessary for the control of the pandemic because they'd looked at blah, 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 all the statistics, etc. What he actually said was, well, I've never really liked the idea of being in a living kind of society where you have to show your papers to do everyday things. Now, to those of us who remember the old debate about ID cards and so on, which the Labour government of Blair and Brown were going to bring in, and which the Conservative and Coalition government decided to scrap, the scheme has decided to scrap it, that was always an argument that was made about ID cards. ID cards were all very well for those continentals like the Germans who don't really understand things like totalitarianism, etc. But for us, it's kind of un-British. You don't have to show anything to anybody to show whether you're an illegal immigrant or whether you've been vaccinated and so on. And so that was Javid's argument. Now, quite apart from the fact there are loads of places where actually people are effectively required to show status of vaccination or testing. So there are actually vaccine passports, and God alone knows you need them in order to travel abroad, but you need them for lots of other places as well. This seemed to me to be a kind of peculiar thing to be saying. And if I were Nadeem Zahawi, the vaccines minister, I wouldn't have been entirely delighted about it, because when he came on the radio this morning, he was then having to try and cast the government's decision entirely in terms of scientific necessity and epidemiological consequence, etc. And I do think that Javid queered the pitch, which is odd, really, because the man's the health minister.
And it goes slightly against Sajid Javid's brand, doesn't he? He's supposed to be the slightly steadier, safe pair of... He's not the most exciting minister in the world, is he?
I can't get myself excited about the thing that's exciting David, actually. I just can't. I think it was perfectly reasonable to say that if we don't need to, when we go to a football match, show the person at the gate that we've had a double COVID vaccination because it doesn't confer solid health benefits, then we shouldn't do it because there's no, you know, because on balance, we don't really want to have to do that. And that's what he was saying. And that is definitely, by the way, part of, I mean, Sajid is a bit more libertarian probably than I am, but or a bit more attracted to that kind of rhetoric than I am. But I didn't find that objectionable in the way that David did. I know David's, you know, got a long-standing view that this kind of, you know, ID is anti-British is bad, you know, sort of is a dead end of an argument. But I don't actually think that's really what was being said here. I think he was just saying, look, we don't have to do this. I'm not in favour of doing it for the sake of it. And I think he's right about that.
No, Danny, he wasn't saying that, because nobody's actually saying, look, let's go and have vaccine passports because we just love the idea. So that was never the argument. Well, nobody ever said, well, we quite like it. You know, I just wish when I was going to a football match, they'd ask me for an extra piece of something so that I could get
there. There is an argument that basically, you know, you can't be too careful. And it doesn't matter if people have to show these papers, and so therefore we shouldn't worry about it. And what he's saying is, well, actually it is a bit of a nuisance, and I don't want to live in a society in which we have to do that, so unless we absolutely have to, we're not going to. That there are definite differences of emphasis, but I don't think it's an unreasonable difference.
Is it also a sort of a slight reflection of when they first started talking about these early in the year, there weren't that many people who had the vaccine, so being able to prove that you'd had a negative test or you'd had the vaccine, you know, was some benefit. But it does reach a point where if most, far and away, most people have had the vaccine and everyone has had the opportunity to get the vaccine, the cost-benefit analysis of big queues of people and all of that is, you know, just to prove that, oh, the vast majority of people have had the vaccine.
Yeah. And we'll start going through the motions as well. So therefore, there'll be a sort of feeling that you are going to look at these papers, but you're not actually going to look at them.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It becomes a bit of a joke. So, you know, I just didn't take a... I understand David's point, of course, as always, but I didn't strike me in the same way.
Okay, well, let's see if we can move on to another topic. Let's talk about Keir Starmer. He's been up this morning giving a virtual speech to the TUC. He's pointed out that last year he did it from his attic, and this time he's doing it from the podium, but still without an audience. And he's hoping that next year it might be in person. The Labour leader's saying he would increase...
Next year will be in a podium in the attic.
yeah, when nobody's told him he's not Labour leader anymore, he's just still carrying on. He's vowed to increase sick pay as part of a package to boost workers' rights. He would increase the minimum wage to at least £10 an hour, he says. And he wants to increase basic rights for workers from day one in the job. So you get holiday pay, protection from unfair dismissal and guaranteed sick pay. So this is at least some policy from Keir Starmer of the Labour Party. Is it the sort of big idea which is going to electrify the nation in a way that hasn't managed yet, David?
Well, there is a big difficulty about this. I mean, we've just had the government last week announcements insofar as you can totally understand them about social care and what the consequences are going to be. And that was by whichever way you looked at it, a very big deal indeed. And what this can tend to look like by way of comparison is a series of kind of nice sort of shopping, essentially a kind of shopping list of possibilities, all of which in themselves might seem desirable, but which don't necessarily of themselves add up to some kind of great big picture about how you see society developing. And the reason why I thought it was interesting, because I wanted Danny's view on this, is that at this point out from a possible general election, the question of the utility of having the shopping list as opposed to the big vision strikes me as problematic. And it may even be problematic to have the very big vision about social care when, by the time you get to an election, you're going to have a contingent reality to deal with and you're going to have to suggest what should be done under those circumstances. And it always strikes me that at this kind of moment, the opposition is on a hiding to nothing if it kind of creates too much and so on. But on the other hand, is always open to the accusation that it's entirely negative if it doesn't have something to say. So it may well be that these are proposals which I've not seen kind of fit that middle distance. And then there's the final thing, which I know that Danny's written about, which is just simply whether or not the personality of the leader and the leadership has the capacity to convey the idea, even possibly without the substance, that you intend big things for the country.
I'm totally against the Leader of the Opposition enumerating detailed policy at this point in the Parliament. And by the way, this is said in sympathy with Keir Starmer, not against him. He's being urged by everybody to do it. It's extremely hard for him to resist it, and it's extremely hard for him to resist the idea that he has nothing to say if he doesn't give some concrete examples. But as far as possible, if it can be resisted, it's not good policymaking, and it doesn't help... electorally either. It doesn't do either of the things that you want it to do. He's not in a position to make policy, not just because of the distance that he is from an election, but having been the head of an opposition policy unit, probably the government had more people working on carpet regulation than we had working on every item of policy. You just don't have the capacity to do it. You're too far from election. The Conservative Party went into the election with a tax guarantee, which was foolish. And even that, which was delivered in the month of the election, turned out to be too early. So these kind of commitments are not a very good idea. You do want to set out what you broadly stand for. I'd quite like to know whether Keir Starmer was left-wing or right-wing within the context of the Labour Party. That'd be a useful thing to know. I'd really broadly like him to know whether he thinks large-scale deficit financing is a good idea or a bad idea, what his view is about taxing income versus unearned wealth, whether he believes the Iraq War was or wasn't a good idea, whether he would anticipate doing the same thing again. Those big things, I'd learn something from that. But him saying what his policy is going to be towards them, towards social care payment in 6 years' time, in the assumption that he was prime minister, is sort of irresponsible for us to urge him to do that, and he shouldn't give in to it.
But isn't what we're getting, as I was just laying out, what Keir Starmer is announcing today, is what, instead of not doing the big stuff, they do lots of dull, small stuff. So yesterday we had... Angela Rayner doing, calling for mandatory COVID checks in venues. I remember writing about Annalise Dodds gave a big speech, a Shadow Chancellor, calling for transparency in the waiving of the social value requirement in public contracts and wanted a national set of good work standards. Well, if you're going to do all that and you're going to set out what the minimum wage should be and, you know, employment rights durations and all that, you're inviting people to say, well, fine, if you're doing that, come up with a big idea that anyone's going to take any notice of.
To be fair to them, some of it is parliamentary. So there's a lot of detail in Parliament. They have to oppose the bills. They have to amend the bills with different detailed amendment. That requires them sometimes to make detailed judgments about, take a position. So to be fair, and secondly, they're under a lot of pressures to do it. But they shouldn't think that, and I'm probably don't, but they shouldn't think by giving into that desire, they're really explaining to anyone what they stand for. And by the way, this is not a point about Labour and Conservative. The Conservatives did this exactly the same thing, and it's really from the Conservative experience that I'm talking. So this is not a specific thing about Keir Starmer. This is about oppositions.
And it's quite, I mean, he's got a particularly tricky opponent, isn't he, Keir Starmer? Boris Johnson has got in a situation where he's got the Labour Party to come out against a tax rise for the NHS, David, in a way that, and I think Danny wrote about this the other day when advising William Hague, the Tories would sit around saying, well, there's no way Tony Blair could do this. And he kept on doing it. And in the same way, the Labour Party, there's no way that Boris Johnson is going to outflank us again on the left.
I well remember going on a programme when Tony Blair was opposition leader, and this with a Conservative commentator who was considerably more Conservative than Danny in many ways. And he was talking about all the ways in which Blair would be condemned by Labour's past and so on. And I said to him, the metaphor that occurred to me was that Tony Blair was like William Sherman marching to the sea through Georgia, which was, everybody said he couldn't do it because he had no supply lines. It was impossible and you couldn't kind of outrun them. But Sherman just went, left everything behind, just went and lived off the land all the way to Savannah. And that essentially is what Blair and to a certain extent Johnson did in terms of the expectations upon them ideologically, which is if they're not convenient, they ditch them. And off they go. And that makes opposition incredibly difficult because you can't necessarily anticipate where your opponent is going to end up. Now, Tories can look at the Labour Party and think, well, with a significant left in the Labour Party, it's always going to be difficult for them to kind of shove off these particular aspects of their history. And they may or may not be right about this. But the thing about Johnson is that he literally doesn't seem to care whether he offends. It's not so much whether he offends. Who he offends actually is quite important, but from day to day, which is why Dominic Cummings said this thing about him. He said, with the Boris Johnson administration, everything is reversible. And then he said, and everything will be reversed. So we had the reversal, we had an apparent reversal on the planning liberalisation, for example, just like that. And nobody said anything. at all. It just happened.
Well, they haven't actually presumably
all the things that he was going to do have now been abandoned.
Well, I suppose, and ultimately, what will be the big test of Boris Johnson? He's very good at making these announcements and then elegantly reversing them, but can he deliver something by the time of the next election? Now, as I mentioned, later on we're going to be talking about Chequers, because it's 100 years since the Prime Minister took over Chequers, or the Chequers was a gift to the nation for the Prime Minister to relax at. David, have you ever been?
I have actually. I went twice.
Oh,
yeah. I went once for one of those evenings there where Cherie Blair showed us around and told us the history of the house. But my biggest memory is that when we came in, it was a cold evening. There was a fire in the grate, etc. And little Leo was watching the television, and I remember the light of the fire shining through his rather big ears as he sat there in his pajamas watching. And I thought, this is kind of rather a nice and cute scene. And then another occasion I went there to talk to Blair about a TV series that I was doing about the Blair years just before he left power. It's quite fun going to Chequers, I think.
Well, I was reading, flicking through Blair's memoirs last night in preparation for it. He did seem to really like Chequers. He he, you know, at times of crisis, I think after 9/11, when he was mulling whether or not he was going to stand down, that was where he went, and he'd sit on the terrace with a glass of wine and strum his guitar, and that's where he made his big decisions. What about what about you, Danny?
Yeah, so several times, you know, a number of different things which show all the different uses of checkers for dinner, for dinners, for some lunches, but a lot also for meetings of ministers and sort of policy discussions which were a bit looser, and they were better for there. So John Major had a series where he, which I was at, which where he brought in first cabinet ministers and then junior ministers in different tranches to discuss what ought to be in a manifesto. And I think that was a nice atmosphere for him to do it. So I don't know any prime minister who hasn't really enjoyed checkers. And it's I think it does do what, you know, the founders who gave it to the nation hoped that it would do. It certainly did it for Churchill and for all the prime ministers that I've encountered or worked with.
It was funny reading some of the history of it. Part of the reason for doing it was because the an awareness of the possibility in the future that not every prime minister would have their own country home.
Exactly. I did get a one chance where David Cameron took my sons into the swimming pool that was given to the nation by Richard Nixon's ambassador. Later I took him to a football dinner and he said to me, "This is the greatest evening." And I said, "But surely you enjoyed like swimming in the Prime Minister's pool?" He said, "Yes, but Petr Cech wasn't there." And I think that does probably put it into as exciting as it is.
Well, lovely. Well, we'll find out. Nobody's yet suggested they'd like Finkelwich as their dream fantasy dinner party guest, but I'm sure that's only a matter of time. Well, so Danny's coming. David, maybe we could tempt you in one week. Do you think...
Tempt me in what?
Not into the swimming pool. No, into the studio.
I've got my podium in my attic. I mean... I would love to be there. But can you fit all three of us in?
I think we can now. As long as we get jet washed down afterwards, it's totally fine.
Okay, it's a deal.
Danny Finkelstein and David Wanovich there, of course. You can read them in The Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, the secret history of checkers.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now, what are you doing Saturday night? Yes, Boris Johnson's having his friends round for dinner this weekend for the ultimate dinner party at Chequers. But what do Ed Balls, Bruce Forsyth, Bill Bryson, Jimmy Carr, Kate Garraway, Lorraine Kelly, Matt Lucas, Davina McCall, John Motson, John Sentamu, Emma Thompson, Jeremy Paxman, Elena Bonham Carter, Harry Enfield, Bobby Charlton and Claudia Schiffer all have in common? Well, they have all been guests at Chequers, the Prime Minister's country retreat set in 1,000 acres of beautiful grounds in Buckinghamshire. It was given to the nation by Sir Arthur Lee, and Lloyd George became the first Prime Minister to take up residence there in 1921, exactly 100 years ago. Well, in a moment we'll find out more about the history. We'll speak to some of the people who've been there. But Boris Johnson's due to host a dinner party there to mark the centenary this weekend, but it's hit a few bumps in the road. Henry Zeffman, Times Chief Political Correspondent, is here with more. So, Henry, explain about the dinner. Who was supposed to be going and who's actually going?
So some weeks ago, the trustees of Chequers who run the estate sent out invitations to every living prime minister. So, of course, that's not just Boris Johnson, but Theresa May, David Cameron, Gordon Brown, Tony Blair and Sir John Major. And I got wind towards the back end of last week that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown had said they couldn't make it. It said there was an unfortunate diary clash, which made this, you know, sounded to me like the most awkward family reunion in history. You know, just the Conservative Party prime ministers, you know, almost all of whom, you know, you choose any two-way relationship among that four and there's bad blood there. But as I've reported in the Times today, it's even more uncomfortable than that. David Cameron and John Major, in fact, can't make it either. So of the former prime ministers, it'll be Theresa May and Boris Johnson, two people who you don't need to know a lot about recent political history to know, do not exactly see eye to eye on a fair number of issues.
Presumably, it's not going to be just them. Are we expecting other, or is it like sort of a scene from, you know, sitting at either end of a very long dining room table?
No, there will be other people who've been involved in Chequers over the years there. And John Major's wife, Dame Norma Major, will be attending. She actually wrote a history of Chequers in 1996, while her husband was still prime minister. So, you know, I don't think it is the case that Boris Johnson and Theresa May will be sitting, you know, across from each other at a small table reminiscing about the last time they were at Chequers together, which was the 2018 Chequers summit where the cabinet agreed to Theresa May's Brexit deal. And then the next day, Boris Johnson quit as her foreign secretary. It would be a little bit awkward if that was the only topic of conversation for the guests there. So there will be others. You know, personally, by the way, I think it reflects very well on Theresa May that she is going. I think she is the person here who seems to be recognising that actually, you know, this residence, this estate does hold a big place in British political history, and that, you know, the office is bigger than its occupants. Although, you know, the other prime ministers absolutely say, stress, they are not snubbing the occasion. They simply have diary clashes. But it does seem to me like it might have been, or ought to have been, a rather important fixture in their diaries.
Thanks so much. That's Henry Zeffman, Chief Political Correspondent for The Times. Well, as you were saying, there is a lot of history in the building. It was from Chequers that Winston Churchill recorded many of his famous wartime addresses to the nation. Margaret Thatcher hosted American President Ronald Reagan, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev there. Tony Blair welcomed the US President Bill Clinton. He also hosted Sinn Féin's Martin McGuinness. But of course, the history goes back even further than that. So let's dive into the history books. Martin Farr is a historian from Newcastle University and knows a lot about Chequers. Joins me now. Hi, Martin.
Hello, Matt.
So whose house was it before it became the Prime Minister's rural hangout?
Well, it was built in the 16th century. It's a Grade One listed building in the Buckinghamshire Hills, the Chilterns. And it was acquired by Arthur Lee, who was a Conservative MP during the First World War, who, and this is where it's interesting, and this is in many ways the historical sort of link with Johnson. I've always thought Johnson has much more in common with this Prime Minister than the one he likes to compare himself with. Lloyd George comes into the picture, who was not averse to trading favours and trading honours. And he made Lee a Viscount, and Lee gave Chequers to the country. And it's been, there was an actual parliament in 1917 which conferred this, but since 21, so it's 100 years, this is the reason for the dinner. It's been the country residence of the Prime Minister. And lots of things have happened there, but nothing as funny as the dinner we're about to witness.
And so why did it then become sort of a gift to the nation? And describe, if you've got it in front of you, the slogan or the legend in the stained glass window.
Oh, I haven't got that in front of me, I'm afraid.
Oh, that's fine. I can do that bit.
Well, you go with the slogan and I'll come in with the context.
Yeah, so the slogan says, "This house of peace and quiet, the peace and ancient memories was given to England as a thank offering for a deliverance in the Great War of 1914 to 1918, as a place of rest and recreation for our Prime Ministers forever."
Yes, and so the war is a very important dimension to this because in many respects, British government becomes modernised by the First World War. The year before Chequers is conferred to the state, we have the cabinet secretary, we have cabinet minutes, and Lloyd George modernises central government. And the following year, we have this, which is the most obvious and the most significant perk of being a prime minister. And the reason being, I think also the context of the chaos of the war and the fact that in 1917, it was by no means guaranteed that Britain would be on the winning side, was that the prime minister required somewhere to reflect, somewhere of peace and solitude, with the high and pure air of the Chiltern Hills, as Viscount Lee called it. So that was an important way of having the prime minister having a kind of bolt hole away from the fetid atmosphere of Westminster in wartime or peacetime. And that's been the attraction ever since. And every prime minister I know has always regarded it as something that was very dear to them and was an important part of them being able to function as prime minister.
Yeah, and in fact, as we saw, you know, early last year, Boris Johnson, you know, chose that was where he went to recuperate after he was in intensive care with COVID. So even the current prime minister, you know, knows the value of having somewhere to retreat from Downing Street. Martin Farr, thanks so much for joining us. Historian from Newcastle University, giving us the history of the building.
Times Radio with Matt Chorley.
Yeah, good morning. It's Matt Chorley with you. We are talking about Chequers, where the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister's country retreat, has been for exactly 100 years. Boris Johnson hosting a dinner to mark the centenary this Saturday, although I think it's only Theresa May is among his predecessors who is attending. As Henry Zeffman explained to us a moment ago, Chequers as a place became sort of synonymous for, in fact, a very stressful situation, which was Theresa May's Brexit deal. It became known as the Chequers deal because it's the one she thrashed out with her ministers on a July weekend in 2018. It didn't go brilliantly well. Ahead of the summit in July, summer's day, an ally of Theresa May joked that taxi cards for Aston's taxis, the local cad firm, would be in the foyer for those who design they can't face making the right decision for the country. Although the threat backfired and David Davis quit the day after and Boris Johnson followed 24 hours later. David Lidington was Theresa May's de facto Deputy Prime Minister, was there and joins me now. Hi, David.
Hi, Matt. Good to speak to you.
Nice to have you with us. So, first of all, I suppose, why were the talks at Chequers? Was it just the case that the stalemate at all the conversations in Downing Street was so bad? Well, let's just try changing the venue.
Well, actually, that is part of it. And it's not, it was more the joke, because if you have a long meeting of the kind that this was going to have to be in London, then ministers attending are going to have messages passed to them from their departments. The civil service feel that ministers are easy to get at. You go out to Chequers, it's a change of scene. There are lots of different rooms. There's a garden where people can get some fresh air, and also means there's space for those private conversations if somebody's unhappy about some aspect of what's being discussed. The Prime Minister or whoever's leading the talks can take them off into a corner, try and sort out whether they can reassure that particular colleague, or perhaps it'll be a visiting leader from some other country. So Chequers is attractive. The other thing about Chequers is that even in the 21st century digital age, it has the most useless mobile phone communications. So actually, one of the stories that got into all the papers about that Chequers meeting under Theresa was that all the ministers said we had to hand in our mobile phones when we went in, which is true, as you do before a cabinet meeting at number 10. And the irony of it is that even if you had your mobile phone with you, you couldn't get a signal. I live about 3 miles away from Chequers. I used to represent the area of the estate in Parliament. And in the Chiltern Hills, you go into certain valleys and the signal just cuts out completely. That's true of Chequers. I think successive prime ministers have been a mix of frustrated but also relieved sometimes. They can't be got a hold of so quickly.
And what is it like as a place? Talk for people who haven't been or haven't seen the pictures. Yeah, just describe it.
It's not a stately home. It's not on the scale of your Longleats or your Wobans. It's a manor house. It's a peasant manor house in parkland, a farmland really, with some sort of trees laid out sort of park style, in the Valley of the Chilterns, with some hills, including Coombe Hill, one of the highest points in the Chiltern Hills, very close to, from which you get good views of the surrounding landscape. Ironically, there's a footpath public footpath actually crosses the grounds of Chequers. And I remember sort of explaining this to American and other foreign visitors, and they looked at me with absolute horror. So, well, how on earth is this permitted? And I tried to explain that if you tried to close the public footpath through the Chequers estate, that you'd have to apply to Buckinghamshire County Council to change their definitive list of footpaths, and there'd be objections, so there'd be a public inquiry into that. And they just shook their heads in disbelief. You know, this is the mad British. But you can go for a very pleasant country walk on public footpaths, but and they go through the Chequers grounds, but don't step off the public footpath. the security is rightly, sadly these days, very, very tight, and sort of athletic, burly men in, you know, balaclavas and jumpsuits will probably come running at you very fast. And that's all changed, I suppose, since the Brighton bomb.
Securities. And I suppose also, you know, it does save the Prime Minister getting too much grief from passers-by who might want to share their thoughts on what they were up to. So,
Boris did get collared when he was pushing, you know, Wilfred, their son, for a sort of in his buggy and near the footpath. And there was a charity fun run that was coming past. There's various people taking selfies of themselves, Prime Minister. They took it all in good spirit.
Of course. David Lidington, thanks very much for joining us. Sir David Lidington there, giving us his reflections on Chequers, where, of course, Theresa May had her Brexit. I think the place might now have shaken off the association with Brexit. I think we've got Sir Nicholas Soames back with us. Are you there, Nicholas?
Yes, I am.
Sorry, apologies about that. That's the perils of technology. You were explaining going to Chequers, of course. Your grandfather was Winston Churchill. You went there when he was Prime Minister.
Well, we did. And as a family, we spent the Christmases, or I think 53 and 54, 54 and 55. I think it was 53 and 54. We spent Christmas there as a family. It's a most wonderful heights. And I realise the reptilian glee on all your parts at the sort of jokey side of this. But it was the most astonishingly generous gift to the nation, for whatever reason, by Lord Leo Farum. It has provided comfort and solace and a place to escape from very, very frantic events, and for prime ministers and their families to recuperate. And it has seen, as you make the point, some of the most important chapters in the history of Britain. And so, quite a lot of that, of course, was written during the Second World War, when my grandfather went to Chequers literally every weekend, except incidentally when the moon was high, when British intelligence discovered that the Germans were going to try and bomb Chequers. So he went, and on the weekends of the full moon, he used to go and stay at a most wonderful house not that far away called Ditchley. But otherwise, he loved being at Chequers. It did provide him with a great haven. I learned to ride my bicycle there. I remember there was this beautiful bike, and I was told that if you can stay on it going down this slope and get to the other side of the lawn, you can have it. And I did it. So I was rather, it has a particularly important meaning to me.
And you're right that when you sort of look at everything that's happened over the years, the people who've walked up that slope or possibly even ridden their bikes, it's such an important part in our history, where the, you know, at times of crisis, it was world leaders meeting their counterparts. Or even your grandfather Winston Churchill recording many of his radio addresses there. Why do you think he chose to do them there rather than it in Downing Street?
I don't know that you're right about that.
Oh,
I don't know that is the case. He may well have done, but it's not that I know of. It is not sort of thought to be a sort of major piece of historical fact. I really don't think that's correct, but it may be. But in which case,
I was looking up with Chequers, which had been reported. Yeah. Turns out it's quite difficult to confirm whether those things are really the case. So this might be another one of those things.
It easily could have done that.
Yes.
It easily could have done. But I don't recall it ever being spoken of. But, I mean, you are absolutely right. Some of the most secret and important meetings of the entire war took place at Chequers. I think Lady Thatcher's meeting with President Gorbachev, earlier meetings with President Reagan. I mean, all the prime ministers have used it for precisely what it was intended for, and have derived great pleasure from it, and comfort, and I think in the ability to perhaps spend some time with their families without being jeered at. So I think it's a wonderful benefaction, and I think all the prime ministers. I think it's a great pity that so few people appear to be going, but any dinner party that has Dame Norma Major in it is one that I would very much like to be asked.
Yeah, in fact, we tried to get her on because her book, her history
she's,
of checkers,
she's much
is...
too modest.
Exactly,
and it is the most wonderful book. Her book on checkers, absolutely wonderful.
Nicholas Soames, thanks very much for joining us on Times
Thank
Radio
you.
There. Former Conservative MP, of course, and grandson of Winston Churchill, learnt to ride his bike at Chequers. Well, there we are. But like I was saying, so many people have walked up and down the paths of Chequers. In 1970, the Queen made her first ever trip to Chequers to meet Richard Nixon during his first state visit to Britain. The United States president was hosted by Ted Heath, and he told the newly elected president, the Prime Minister, that he wanted to establish a close personal communication. Well, Richard Nixon received such a warm welcome during that trip that the US ambassador paid for a swimming pool to be installed at Chequers as a thank you. When Margaret Thatcher became Prime Minister, she was apparently so worried about the running costs, she had the pool's heating switched off. And then in a speech in 2012, David Cameron revealed just this.
Edward Heath and Richard Nixon took personal awkwardness with each other to new and excruciating levels. And yet, despite this, Richard Nixon arranged for someone to pay for the swimming pool at the Prime Minister's country residence of Chequers. Incidentally, this swimming pool now has a serious and possibly terminal leak.
And we all know you don't want leaks from Chequers, which is very much what successive prime ministers have tried to avoid when they've been there to have meetings. But in 2017, Theresa May summoned her key advisers to Chequers. She served them to discuss having a snap general election. She apparently served them chicken lasagna and boiled potatoes. delicious. She wasn't the only one to call to take the decision to hold a snap election there. Howard Wilson did the same thing. He took his cabinet there in 1970 to sign off a snap election. He then lost, which is why it was Ted Heath who ended up hosting Nixon. Food and drink is particularly important. Margaret Thatcher said, I assure you, told the Commons once that the whiskey served at Chequers and at number 10 is genuine Scotch whiskey, and it was very good. And there's lots of talk of parties. Parties are very popular. Gus O'Donnell, the former cabinet secretary, once described how on becoming Prime Minister, one of his first decisions for John Major was to decide what to do at Chequers.
How do you want to use Chequers? Not just your Downing Street home, yeah. But this other place. It's a great place for bonding. You might want to bring some people together. You've got some thank yous to do. You know, receptions. I remember one of my joys when John Major became Prime Minister and I was just his press secretary, is I went in to talk to him about some press issues, and he had a piece of paper in front of him and said, well, Margaret Thatcher was due to have a reception, and you know, they've now given it to me because the date's on the diary, but we haven't got a guest list. So I said, well, Bobby Charlton. And then we just reeled out these people that we'd all love to meet, and there
That's
they
amazing.
Were. And
we so all who else was there? Up. Bobby Charlton.
We had Jenny Agutter, I remember, a whole bunch of cricketers. I mean, it was just, you know, people you'd like to meet.
Yeah, people you'd like to meet, including, and successive prime ministers have done this, that great long list I mentioned at the start. But David Cameron in 2014 used Chequers to stage a rave for a belated 40th birthday for his wife, Samantha. Guests included Harry Enfield, actress Helena Bonham Carter, Jeremy Clarkson was there as well, all treated the spectacle of David Cameron throwing shapes on the dance floor to music being played by the DJ Sarah HB. Here apparently is a song that David Cameron was getting down to. And one person who knows what David Cameron used to like to get up to at Chequers is his former press secretary, Gabby Burton, who joins me now. Hi, Gabby.
Hi, Matt.
Does this song bring back memories? Were you there?
I was there. Do you know what? This song doesn't bring back memories, but I do remember thinking that we could have had a bit more cheese on that night for sure. But
oh, was it a bit too cool?
I have to say, I could have listened to Sir Nicholas Soames talking about his experience at Chequers all day. I mean, the history of that place is what really hits you when you go there. And, you know, the long room that we've spoken about. I mean, the things that you will never be able to see in any museum. So, for example, the ring that Anne Boleyn used to wear, the swords from Cromwell's time, the sort of biggest collection of Cromwell memorabilia sits in Chequers. The art that apparently, I mean, again, maybe Sir Nicholas has a view on this, but Winston Churchill apparently used to make the art much better and would draw things into these very, very beautiful paintings like little mice and all the rest of it. So there are some great, great things to sort of look around, and it was always a huge honour. And I think I have to say that it's only former prime ministers that would refuse an invite to Chequers. You can literally ask anyone, and nearly everyone will say yes, because it is just such a special thing.
You mentioned, in fact, Miranda messaged in because she said we hadn't yet mentioned the collection of Cromwell memorabilia and so on. And actually, when I was reading around it, there was quite a lot of times when at various times people have shown some sort of Cromwell memorabilia to people. I'm not sure if it was, I think it was, Sarah Brown, I think, wrote about how she once was showing off the Cromwell memorabilia, and she realised the person she was showing off to was Prince Andrew, and the royals might not be massive fans of looking at Cromwell memorabilia. And I think Tony Blair did a similar thing, was showing it off to Martin McGuinness, which again, the politics of all of that is interesting. And but because the history goes back so far, there's a secret spiral staircase up to the prison room where Lady Mary Grey was held for 2 years on the order of Elizabeth I.
Quite a spooky thing happened to me.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Tell me about your ghost story at Chequers.
So I was heavily pregnant, and I did used to organise, a bit like Gus O'Donnell, I as press secretary, I was tasked with organising various sort of dinners and you know, soft power sort of gatherings. And I was just too sort of pregnant to drive home after one of these. It was too late. So anyway, I was given the lovely room, lovely cold room, the prison room, and I thought, my God, you know, this doesn't sound great. But anyway, you go up there. Of course, it's not a sort of prison room like you would expect it these days. It's a beautiful suite of apartments. I mean, not probably that beautiful if you had to stay there for 2 years, which, as I understand, you did have to. But anyway, so I went to bed and had a lovely night's sleep. There was nothing creepy about the room at all. It felt, you know, lovely and warm. But I woke up and the door had been bolted from the inside. The two massive great big bolts, on one on the top, one on the bottom, had been bolted. And I just would never, ever have done that.
Wow. That's... Yeah. So who do you think was?
I mean, terrified of fire. I never wanted to be sort of locked in a room, especially now. And not least, you have the police sort of sleeping down the corridor. So it's not a room that you're really scared for your security. So, yeah, I was pretty freaked out by that. I didn't stay again.
Well, it's a good story, though. It's a good story, though. Gabby Burton, thanks very much for sharing your... the spooky goings on at Chequers. And as we've heard, I mean, so many prime ministers have found solace there over the years, ever since David Lloyd George became the first prime minister to stay there after it was gifted to the nation back in 1921. In 1923, Stanley Baldwin made the decision to stay on as PM, despite losing his majority during a stay at Chequers. In 1939, Neville Chamberlain found himself on the verge of a nervous breakdown while walking in the grounds. Apparently, he often used to retreat to tend the roses in the garden. Winston Churchill, we heard a lot about there from Nicholas Soames. He apparently sacked the cook for not making the soup properly and once turned the Long Gallery into a cinema to watch films there. Clement Attlee apparently hosted children's parties there. Margaret Thatcher once wrote, "I do not think anyone has stayed long at Chequers without falling in love with it." She used to spend her Christmases there, although famously quite often with Jimmy Savile, which we perhaps won't dwell on now. James Callaghan used to also spend Christmas there, as did Tony Blair. Tony Blair famously met Diana, Princess of Wales, there about a month before her death. They walked in the grounds while discussing a relationship with Dodi Fayed before Tony Blair joined Prince William for a football match on the lawn, maybe right next to the path where... Nicholas Soames learned how to ride his bike. And it was in that summer, in those hot summers, that Tony Blair would sit in the grounds with a glass of wine, strumming his guitar and mulling over what to do, whether it was the fallout of 9/11, the invasion of Iraq, and then making the decision on when to resign. These days, apparently Boris Johnson struggles to relax there because there have been reports that Dylan the dog keeps chewing the furniture and soiling the carpets, which I suppose will at least give them something to talk about over dinner on Saturday night. That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Looking for inspiring stories? Listen to the EY Leading Into Tomorrow podcast. It features compelling stories from leaders across government and the public sector who've transformed their organizations and services. From the impact of grants to how digital innovation is reshaping affordable childcare, you'll get actionable insights and ideas that can be used around the world. Download Leading Into Tomorrow by EY wherever you get your podcasts.